Education Economic Development. It is Thursday, March 20th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open up as a subcommittee of the subcommittee for an informational meeting on small business development centers. And with the tap of the gavel, we'll do that. Senator Carter.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, and
good morning.
Thank you very much. Today is a very special day, and that we as a state have the opportunity to listen to the departing words of a person who has worked very hard in the infancy, if you will, of small business development centers in this state. I remember in 1985, when I first came to the legislature, the gentleman that we're going to be introducing in just a few minutes was on everybody's last nerve in terms of economic development and small business centers connected with community colleges. And he wanted to make sure that dollars that went to economic development truly had a purpose and a cause that would help to grow small businesses in the state, but also have the connectors between small and large businesses. And I can't think of a greater person for us to be listening to today in terms of any messages that he have to us in terms of the future and things that he wants to continue to see the state do and direct itself towards in terms of small business operations and how we continue to develop and grow small businesses. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm really very glad to invite to our chair this morning Sandy Cutler, who will be retiring soon. And we will certainly miss you, Sandy, and thank you very much for your graciousness of work and for your thoughts in terms of how to bring the state together in terms of economic development.
Welcome, Sandy.
Chairman George and Senator Carter, thank you. For the record, I'm Sandy Cutler. I'm the state director of the Small Business Development Centers, and I very much appreciate the courtesy that you've extended me this morning to be here. I had hoped to be here during the Economic Development Department budget hearings, but I have a longstanding commitment that I'll be out of state during that time and when they got shifted to April. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'll keep my remarks very brief, but I will begin by going back to 1983 when this program was started. The unemployment rate in Lane County in 1983 was 16%. The prime lending rate for businesses to get loans, the interest rate for loans in 1983 was 21%. The reason that this program was started, and it was started, by the way, with then Representative Bill Bradbury's, was his idea with some others to do something to stimulate economic development throughout Oregon. And his concept, his idea was, let's use the community colleges as a way to work with the businesses to help teach them how to run their businesses better. And because of his vision and lots of hard work by lots of people, it's really worked incredibly well. So I'm happy to be here to tell you, share with you just a few things about where we are currently, some successes. I have a packet that I prepared for you. See the state map on the front that shows that there are 19 SBDCs located around the state. 16 of them are located at community colleges, and 3 are at state universities. The next page has Oregon small business data. This is actually quite interesting about the importance of small business to the overall Oregon economy. 296,000 small businesses in Oregon, and most of those actually are very, very small businesses. We classify a small business as 50 or fewer employees. And that is the majority of small businesses. And those small businesses employ almost half, 49% of the workforce. I didn't include it in this packet, but very interesting piece of data is that in the last year, 01 to 02, according to Employment Department records, businesses with more than 50 employees lost 35,000 employees, and businesses with 49 or less employees actually lost 11,000 employees. So there was a loss in every sector, but it's significant, I think, that the smaller businesses lost a lot fewer employees. There's a reason for that. The smaller businesses are more resilient, and also when they have a good employee, they can't afford to let him go because it takes too long to find a good employee and to train them. So Small businesses are really the engine of economic recovery and economic development. They're well diversified, and they reach into every community. The next page is just a quick summary of our services. I don't think I need to go over that with you. You know that we do one-to-one counseling, business training, information and referrals, and we help people write business plans, write marketing plans, help them with accounting, setting up their chart of accounts, and how to understand financial statements. The next page is a profile of our business clients. It's interesting to look at the different categories. We very much mirror the state categories in terms of service, retail, and construction, and so on. But what's of note is that actually 17% of our businesses are manufacturers. That's much higher. That's about 7 to 10% higher than the state average. That's a purposeful decision. We focused on working with manufacturers because of the whole issue of trying to work with traded sector businesses and to work with manufacturers because we understand the value that they provide to the economy. In terms of the number of people we touch, it's more than 10,000 businesses a year between our one-to-one counseling and our training. And as far as demographics, 40% of our clients are women, 10% are minorities, and 60% are actually located in rural zip codes. So we reach throughout the state. The second most important thing I want to chat about today is this page, and then the most important will be the following page. Just to make sure that folks are clearly cognizant of how our budget is constructed, starting in the upper right-hand quarter, 21% of our funding comes from the SBA. That's federal funds. 24% comes from the state, and the state in this case, what we mean by the state is the Economic Development Department. We are a line item within the OECDD budget, and that's why I asked for the courtesy, and I really appreciate being able to be here and just share information about our budget now rather than in April. And that money is invaluable, and we have a very strong partnership. We are very codependent with the Economic Development Department in terms of the funding that we get from them, the support we get, and the work that we do together to help stimulate economic development. We end up being that delivery system throughout Oregon for them in terms of small business initiatives. The majority of our funding, actually 41%, comes from the community colleges and universities, and this is the part of our funding that is currently at the most at risk. That's because we've seen tremendous cuts in the community college budget. Those cuts have translated into cuts in the local funding that some of the colleges are putting into the SBDC program. In the last year, we've actually lost between about $450,000 overall of funding through Portland Community College has cut back, Lane has cut back, Southwestern Oregon has cut back, Rogue has cut back, Tillamook Bay has cut back. I mean, I can give you that list. It's all over the state, and the cuts are serious. We're also, though, quite pleased and proud to point out that 14% of our budget comes from what we call program income. That would be fees that we charge for our training and services. We have products that we sell. We have a wonderful business planning workbook, and we generate revenues through that. We sell software, and we do whatever we can to be entrepreneurial and to generate additional funds. Without that program income, by the way, we would not have been able to be as successful as we are today. If you turn to the next page, this is very, very important. We talk about return on investment. Last year, the Economic Development Department had a small business assessment that was conducted by an independent group out of Portland. They interviewed, many thousand of small businesses, and it was a very totally reliable and valid survey. They reported back that in 2002, so this is for 1 year, you could double these figures for a biennium, that the SBDC clients created 2,676 new jobs. There were 1,100 new businesses that got started, $66 million in new sales, and most notable is the $44 million in new payroll. Those are new taxes that are going in to help balance the budget. And those new jobs, if without those new jobs, that job loss that I cited earlier would have been even more. So these folks are really doing a great job because of the assistance that they've got from the SBDC. The next page is what our clients say about the quality of our services. They really like what we're doing on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being high, very high marks on all categories. Everything's above a 4. Business plan assistance, marketing plan, accounting assistance, new products and personnel. And with that, I'll stop and would be happy to answer any questions that you have or any comments that you might have as well.
Well, Sandy, we certainly do appreciate your service and basically for kind of parenting the operation along, and particularly, as both Senator Carter and I have experienced, to be able to talk to small businesses that are experiencing at the local community college, the benefits of these programs. And for those of us who started off with maybe only background being what we learned in high school or something like that, and maybe some college classes, you think today the complexity of regulation and requirements of reporting, it's a difficult thing to begin a new business. And so, I'm with you when I saw the percentage of that was in community college university system, as far as the percentage of your total budget, the first thought you have is, oh my goodness, because we know that those dollars are very short.
They are.
So we certainly do want to commend you and thank you for your service.
Well, I'd like to thank Senator George, thank you, and Senator Carter. We have had a long-standing relationship of support, and we appreciate the support that the legislature has afforded us over the years. It's a partnership, and we're doing our part to provide the best quality services that we can, and you've done your part to provide the funding to allow us to do that. We appreciate it. We'll continue to do this work, and I think together we can help be part of the solution in bringing the economy back to a vibrant and very successful economy here in Oregon.
Good morning. Good morning. Any further comments or questions? Well, Senator Carter, I want to thank you also for inviting Sandy to come in for this presentation. And without questions, and I'm just going to state it one more time, as we in government have added the burden on particularly small startup businesses, it's just almost imperative that we help them then to meet those regulations and the new, business environment.
Well, the interesting thing is that small businesses, number one, hire more people from local levels. And when we consider the economy, especially in the rural Oregon, I listened to Sandy who said that unemployment in his area was 16%. In North Northeast Portland, it was 23% when I came to the legislature.
Mm.
23% unemployment in our district. So thank you.
Quick comment. I'm Multnomah County Commissioner for 8 years, and during that time, we created more small businesses than almost any county. Unfortunately, they had started as large businesses.
And the trend continues.
Well, thank you again
thank
for
you
the courtesy.
Again for your time. You. And with that, are we ready? Yes, Senator.
Have you guys decided on your successor?
We're in the process. We had 26 applicants, did the paper screening about 2 weeks ago. We'll be extending interviews to 6 individuals. 2 of those are from in-state, 4 from out-of-state. And there's a committee that involves our state advisory council, some SBDC directors, and economic development folks in SBA that will be sitting on the interview committee to find my successor.
No, that's fine. Well, with that, we'll thank you again, and
you.
We will adjourn the informational meeting on small business development centers, and we'll tap the gavel if we'll be adjourned.
run testify.
I know, we won't. We'll bring Jim up first.
Thank you,
man. And Mary can talk for a while, so it'll be okay.
Right, Kristen?
I'm going to call the committee to order. We're here today on House Bill 5045. This is the public testimony part of the Oregon State Police budget. We have several people who are here to sign up today, and I'd ask if Jim, if you want to come up first.
Mr. Chair, I've known Jim Buckrunis for going on 4+ years, and this is the first time I've ever seen him in uniform. I didn't realize he was a state trooper all of this time.
Oh.
I didn't. I honestly didn't.
He's not just a state trooper. He's a senior trooper.
I've been
representative.
Pardon. Okay. Senior trooper. Pardon me. Extra set of stripes or stars or something. I beg your pardon.
Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Botwinus. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. And as you can tell, I sit before you today in uniform as a very proud Oregon State Police trooper. I wanted to take a few minutes of your time today to talk about and follow up on some issues that we heard during testimony or what I read in the Oregonian yesterday. The comment that was in the Oregonian yesterday was a statement made by Senator Schrader about this committee, which was that the public safety, this is a quote, the public safety committee will wrestle with the relative importance of crime labs versus the court system versus the Oregon State Police. And throughout the hearings, through questioning or maybe comments from the committee, I've heard what I thought was comments similar to we need to figure out how to bridge the gap of the current funding problems that we have in the budget and do a prioritization within the Oregon State Police and the public safety silo. With that said, and with all due respect, it certainly should be no secret to anybody that's sitting in this room that OSP has been on a downhill journey for 20-plus years. And that has been the case as state government, over many years, grew and new programs were implemented, and while that was occurring, OSP continued its downhill journey. And now it is being asked to prioritize. We have prioritized, and we have prioritized for years. There is nothing left to prioritize. We've been stripped for 20 years, and I don't know where the prioritization, quite frankly, would come in our organization. I mean, if you're going to find it, we're talking peanuts is what we're talking. We're not talking anything that's going to substantially increase or change the department or its funding mechanisms. If we don't fund public safety at 100%, and I'm not just now talking about just OSP, but public safety as a whole, what messages are we sending to our citizens and our visitors? What crimes are acceptable versus what crimes are not acceptable? Does our crime lab system only process evidence against crimes against persons, or does it only process drug-related evidence, or vice versa? And I would tell you that neither is acceptable. Drug crimes lead to all sorts of other crime, including crimes against persons. Do we fully staff our command centers or do we partially staff them? I once again would tell you that it's not acceptable to partially staff them. Those centers are the very lifeline that our citizens rely upon to report crime or report traffic violations. And those centers are the lifeline of the troopers out there who rely upon them for their own safety to get their jobs done. Do we put more emphasis on the Fish and Wildlife Division versus the detectives versus the patrol division? And I would tell you that none of those are acceptable options. Our fish and wildlife officers protect our natural resources and our wildlife. Our detectives protect our children and families from violent crimes and remove drug dealers from our streets. And our patrol troopers protect our children while en route to and from school. They protect us while we sit in our homes, and they protect us while we drive on Oregon highways. And all three of these groups do a multitude of other assignments. How do we prioritize the infrastructure of the organization itself? The only answer I can give you is that it takes a sufficient number of people to keep the law enforcement agency afloat and make the people who are out protecting us every day as efficient as we can make them. It does little good to have a trooper setting in doing secretarial work or whatever the case may be. We pay them a lot of money to go out and protect us, and that's where they ought to be. So if we don't finance the infrastructure of the organization, we create another problem for the organization. I want to ask you if any of you, and you don't have to answer this obviously, but have you ever been the victim of a crime? I can tell you that I have been, and it is very demoralizing. And it happened when I was a trooper. Once when I was not, and once when I was. And the response from the responding agency at the time was basically kind of what we're hearing now. What do you what's prioritized? What gets investigated versus what doesn't get investigated? And it lends people to believe after a while, as it did with me, that it violates everything that you thought your country stood for. What I thought I worked for, I thought was mine. And I didn't think that somebody else had a right to take it. And if they did, they were going to get arrested, prosecuted, and put in jail for it. That is part of the total public safety system. And it is falling apart in Oregon, from my perspective. Schools would tell you that we should educate our kids first to prevent crime. And human services would tell you that we should give money to the needy to prevent crime. I don't disagree with any of those statements. But at the same time, they have never been, and they never will be, a fail-safe for our society. Public safety is always going to need to be there to pick up the pieces left behind that education does not take care of or that human services do not take care of. Therefore, from our perspective, it becomes a matter that we must fund public safety fully. And that provides public safety the opportunity to provide that safety net for the citizens and visitors of our state. Again, I think it's important, I don't think this can be said enough, is that our department has nothing left to prioritize. It just simply doesn't exist anymore. We have reduced ourselves to a level of providing less than 24-hour-a-day coverage 24 hours a day. Our crime labs can't keep up with the workload. Our command centers are understaffed. We have a communication system that's in dire need of updating. And our infrastructure has been hit hard. You heard on the first day an opening testimony from the FBI, representative from the Sheriff's Association, the Chief's Association, the DA's Association, Chief Mark Croker from Portland Police Bureau, about how important all of the services of the Oregon State Police were. I would tell you that I think that is the first time in a long time that you have seen a group of people like that from every agency representing law enforcement coming in and testifying on behalf of the Department of State Police budget. I think that speaks volumes about the efforts that the department has made to try and gain a cooperative working relationship with all of those agencies. We are a vital part of the total public safety net that is out there. Public safety is like a puzzle. You don't get the whole picture until all the pieces are put together. If there's a missing piece, the picture is unclear, and it starts to fall apart. And that is what's happening to the Oregon State Police, and that is what is happening to public safety in Oregon in general. We think that when you look at the dollars that are being spent on OSP, which is, I believe, about 1.5 cents on the dollar right now, maybe a little less, that you're getting a good value for your money. We just went through 286 employee layoff. We brought back 40 scientists. We brought back 45 troopers. And we've had a bunch of them get hired by other agencies. And we've heard from several of those agencies that if they could fill all their vacancies with troopers, they would do it in a heartbeat because they have never seen a group of people with more ethical values and work values than they got from the troopers they got from us. And I will tell you, I think you would find that department-wide. That is how our employees are. That is the kind of an agency we are. We are a very proud organization. We are proud to provide services to the public, and I think we do a really good job at it, a very good job at it. So I guess the bottom line for us is that we have worked really closely with the legislature over the years to ensure that the department spends its taxpayer dollars wisely. We believe the department has achieved a level of efficiency that not many other state agencies could even come close to measuring up to. So we're asking you for your support in this committee and any conversations that may be had with the full Ways and Means Committee about the department's budget, that the Oregon State Police get funded at a level that allows us to do our job, which is protecting the citizens of our state and allowing for some safety of our employees out there doing their jobs. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Jim? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, we've submitted some requests for information relative to training and those kinds of things to see if we can't identify where the training is occurring and retraining and those kinds of things. I know the training is extremely important, but we do have OSP members who are assigned to some areas where maybe training isn't quite, or particularly some of the repetitive training isn't quite as critical. Is that something that you can support?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think what makes our organization is the training that our troopers get. And we must remember that our troopers, while they work in geographic areas of the state, they are also called upon to respond to any given issue that happens in the state. And we stand a great chance right now with what appears to be a full-fledged war with Iraq of doing exactly that. We will have our troopers in various parts of the state pulling from other parts of the state to go to another part of the state to handle issues. And it is critical that our people all have the same type of training and they know how to be able to work with one another when those situations arise.
Follow-up questions? Thank you. I know last session in public safety, Jim, you and your organization came together to develop a pretty good program how to better blend the number of staff with the number of supervisors. The ratio that you were seeking at that time, which I felt was an absolutely excellent solution to a portion of our problem at that time, was evidently agreed upon, or at least some unanimity of opinion occurred. Are we out of sync with that original arrangement from 2 years ago, Jim?
Representative Patridge and Representative Butler, I don't know that we're that far out of whack with it. I mean, could you be a little bit because of layoffs, et cetera? Yeah, I'm recalling people back and maybe waiting to see what's going to happen with this budget. Maybe. I don't know from my perspective that it does a lot of good to be jockeying around the management people you have if there's a potential that we might get some people back and you push all these people down and then you've got to turn right around and re-promote people back up again. So, I don't know. Are we right at the very immediate moment? Possibly. But who knows? I mean, I think the department has plans in place to adjust that if it needs to be adjusted.
Okay.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I don't disagree with the basics thrust of your testimony, which I think what you're saying is that if you cut the department any farther, you're not going to have the critical mass to do your mission. But the budget reality that we're in is we make the same statement for education. If we cut at the levels that we're looking at, based on the governor's budget with the adjustments that have to be made, the critical mass in my district for schools, I don't know if public education can survive in Portland with that type of cut. The same thing in terms of health and human services, cuts at that level, I think people are going to die from lack of prescription drugs and it's just incredibly dire, the revenue situation that we're in now in terms of maintaining the critical mass for public safety, for education, for human services. And when when we identify, if we prioritize one ahead of the other, it means that the cuts go into even deeper into the other. And I don't think that's something that we're going to be ending up being able to do. But part of our job is to come up with the very best budgets we can at this point, and then hope that when the public sees what we have to offer at the revenue that we have, there'll be demands for changes, and certainly I'd hope that we have your help and cooperation at that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I appreciate your comments, and I know that this entire legislative body is going to be in a real predicament about trying to figure out where their dollars are going to come from and how they're going to put budgets together. But I have to tell you that it's very hard for those of us in the law enforcement side to watch the scrutiny that we have gone under and not watch that same scrutiny go on with other organizations and get into them with an absolute fine-tooth comb, put them under a magnifying glass, and look at them budget cycle after budget cycle after budget cycle and say, you need to cut, you need to cut, you need to cut, you need to prioritize. I don't see that happening in the other organizations. And let me just give you a little example, and I'm not anti-education in any way, shape, or form. We must educate our kids. I live in where the Salem-Keizer School District. We built a brand new high school in West Salem. That's where I live. We needed a high school in West Salem, and I supported a high school in West Salem. Bottom line was, did we need a Taj Mahal in West Salem? I don't think we did. And when they overspent on their budget to build that school, the money they overspent on was enough money to keep our 286 employees at work. And yet it was like it was no big deal to them that they went over budget, and it was no big deal to those who are strong school supporters that they went over budget. That is very disconcerting that you see those kinds of things happening, and you watch your own organization, who is the very strength behind state government and protecting its citizens, watch it crumbling around itself. That is very hard to deal with.
Other questions for Jim?
Thanks, Jim. We'll appreciate your time. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Council 75 with me is Gordon O'Brien, who is the president of our non-uniformed staff local at the Oregon State Police. I want to say a couple of things. And I'm not gonna repeat what I said this morning. You know how I feel about breathalyzer tests and all of those things. And
President Butler already left. So.
Yeah, you know, bad guys and, you know, alcohol don't mix, and we gotta, like, do everything we can. But I want to say a couple of things about public safety, and I could not agree with what Mr. Botwin has said more. You know, I often say that from the minute one of your constituents picks up their phone and dials 911, you're inextricably linked to the public safety system in Oregon. Whether they want to be or not, you know, we get your constituents at the worst possible time in their lives. You know, none of them really want to call us. You know, we're not like firefighters. They don't want to see us coming. They don't want to see Jim roll up in front of their house, okay? It means something really bad has happened. And the whole public safety system, as Jim said, is a mosaic of divisions and departments and positions and people who do very important work. You know, we think having state police officers patrolling the highways and helping us, you know, bust bad guys and end crime, you know, there's no higher calling. But underneath all of the really wonderful things that those state troopers are doing for us is, it's like an ant farm of people who support that activity. And
is that a bad analogy?
Just occurred to me that the members can be offended by that analogy. But you know, it is. It's like, you know, these folks are the people who process the evidence and who make sure that everything is put in place. And one piece doesn't fit together well without another piece. And I don't care whether you're talking about OLCC and their work with the state police, or if you're talking about the Portland Police Bureau or the County Sheriff Department, everything fits together. You know, and we get them all. We get them from the point that they pick up the phone until they either end up in prison or, in the morgue. You know, it is an ugly life in some cases, but somebody has to do it. And I can't imagine, you know, and I guess that my question is, how much can they do? For how long? And I was sitting back there, I was looking at my papers to see if I had the actual numbers, and Bill McGee will, you know, immediately correct me if I'm wrong. Or, you know, one of you will, I know. But as I recall, public safety used to be about 14% of the entire general fund. And if I remember right, we're down to 7. Okay.
You forgot about DOC.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that would be that other little budget I have. But, you know, I mean, the point is that this budget is not a budget that's growing. This is a budget that has taken a hit every 2 years for the last decade. And I agree with Mr. Botmanis. I don't know how much further we go to cut corners. I don't know how much more efficiency we can find and still function. You know, and at some point, I love K-12. I love higher ed. We've got people who work in both of those areas. But I can tell you, I've never had to sit in the education budget in the sub and go through line by line by line and justify every position like I do in this sub. And I don't resent having to do that. I'm okay with that, and our members are okay with that. But I agree with Jim. We got to treat everybody the same. And somehow or other, we have to squeeze the economies everywhere equally. And while we're squeezing economies, you know, sign me up for the Tax Me More Committee. You know, our organization was the largest contributor to the passage of Ballot Measure 28. And we do it again tomorrow. Because we think it's the right thing to do, and at some point the pie just doesn't have enough. There's not enough cherries in that pie anymore. We need to figure out how to get more fruit in it. And, you know, we're in it for the long haul, Mr. Chair. You know, if you want to talk about more taxes, we're there. You want to talk about different taxes, we're there. You want to talk about getting rid of tax incentives, we're there. We're willing to have any discussion. We've been there on the budget cuts, and we've offered up our own. And I just don't know where there's any more. And I really do want Gordon to talk about really what he does and the importance of what to do, because I do think that sometimes talking to real folks who do the real work makes more sense than talking from all of us who just watch them do the real work. Thank you.
O'Brien, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Gordon O'Brien. I'm the president of AFSCME Local 896, representing the classified employees of the state police. I'm also an employee of the department at the Portland Forensics Laboratory and soon to be transferring to the Springfield Laboratory. With some of the budget cuts and layoffs that we had, we lost several employees that work in the patrol offices maintaining the evidence lockers there that were civilian employees. Those positions are now being covered by state troopers, taking up the time off the road to do those kind of duties. The previous employees that held those positions were given specialized training with refresher courses every year or so to make sure that they were kept up on the evidence handling techniques and everything else that they needed for that. Some of the other areas that our people deal with are the criminal history background checks out of ID services under LEDS. doing background checks for employment for teachers, daycare workers, and those types of individuals. We also deal with the forensics labs, like I said, where I work. And with some of the layoffs, we had people that could that were dealing with the convicted offender database samples that were coming in. The people that were originally hired to deal with those samples were all laid off, and it took people off of casework or other people around the lab to deal with those types of evidence. One of the reasons I'm transferring to the Springfield lab is because during the layoffs, they lost all of the support staff down there. And the clerical person that was offered her position back said that she did not want to come back and go through that process again if there was no stable funding for her position. I'm able to do her job as well as the lab tech support position down there. So I requested a voluntary transfer so that that laboratory could continue its critical missions and log in the evidence. Right now they have a forensic scientist that is doing logging in the evidence, taking that person away from casework. Some of the other aspects that we deal with are personnel issues, payroll issues. A lot of the infrastructure of the department is based on the civilian employees. One of the things that is similar with us on the support staff is that we also can be subpoenaed to testify in court. And I was telling Mary earlier that on the 7th of next month, I'm potentially going to be in Grant County testifying solely for the fact because I opened a piece of evidence in the lab, the packaging that came in, to log it into the laboratory. The support staff could be called to testify just to say that how we got it in and to verify that part of it. As far as the laboratories go, in the Portland lab is the one I know the best about. Submissions of evidence have been down this year. Typically, we get maybe 1,200 to 1,300 cases or agency cases submitted to us a month. As of yesterday, we were less than 1,700 cases into the Portland lab. My personal feeling of why that is the agencies aren't sure if we're going to have the staffing to work the cases in a timely manner. I know the Springfield lab is also down, as I'm sure you are aware from testimony from our division leadership earlier this week. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and yeah, happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Devlin.
Marion, thank you for coming in. I understand the comments that have been made. I probably agree with them, actually. But I think the difficulty the committee's having, and if I could just have a little bit of latitude here, I think this is a totally different time. You know, if the chair here was talking, he's got to find $5 or $10 million to cut in public safety. You know, I'd accept your argument 100%, and I think we could probably do that. But the chair's been given a figure of about $143 million to cut from public safety. And public safety is not unique in this circumstance, but it is probably the best example, is that it's more of a system than it is individual components. You know, you've got to be able to apprehend someone. You have to be able to try them. You actually have to be able to defend them, too. Then you have to be able to sanction them. Hopefully, if they're going probation and parole, you've got to have people to supervise them. So everything that you cut has an impact on the rest of the system. So I'd agree with you 100%, but I've looked at these numbers for the other subcommittee chairs, the ones that have major general fund dollars, and I've seen one of them at least approach one other subcommittee chair and say, I think I need to borrow from your subcommittee. And I think the typical argument has been something like, I won't use the typical response to that, but I just think this is just unbelievable times. I mean, I don't even... The chair and I were talking yesterday about this 143, and I thought I could find, if I looked really hard, I thought I could find 40 to 50. What did the chair say he thought he could find?
30.
I just don't know how you get through this. I mean, barring a change in the public's attitude and barring some change in the economy, one or the other, I just think these budgets are all going to be pretty disastrous.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I know that there's not really a question in that statement, and I appreciate your comments. And
I'm just trying to be candid.
And I will share with you that I testified in front of the Audit Committee, I guess a couple of weeks ago, and I told the chair down there that I felt like I was, you know, a victim of somebody who had been shoved into a pinball machine designed by Freddy Krueger, that I just bounced from hearing room to hearing room watching kind of the slashing, gashing, and devastation that's being caused. And Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I used to say, with the exception of this hearing room, from the minute you pick up a phone and dial 911, you're talking to a AFSCME member. You know, in this case, you might be talking to one of Jim's members for the State Police 911 Center. But, you know, the point is that we understand this. And, you know, we're going to help you get through this. We're not going to like it any better than you do. And I don't disagree with you. Ballot Measure 28 was our last best effort at this point at getting more money into this building to stop some of these cuts. We're gonna even foolishly support that thing up in Portland, you know, because we're just victims for punishment here. You know, I'm serious. I mean, it is that we are as desperate as you are as an organization and as a union. We are supporting every effort we can find to raise either new money or change existing money or stop the bleeding. And Senator George, you know, I said something to him the other day, but he's going to be really cranky with me because I was going to suggest that we get rid of some of these tax breaks. You know, just stop the bleeding at this point, and let's hold on to the money that we do get. And I'm there. We're there. Organizationally, we're there. Ralph is down the hall in revenue trying to figure out ways to stop the bleeding. I mean, we're going to do it at both ends of the building. So I wish you luck, and we'll be here for all the work sessions.
Thanks, Mary.
Just to remind you that, you know, it's, you know, Jim, we need the uniforms or we need the non-uniforms. It's not, you don't get the luxury of making choices between those two groups. You've got to have both. And I don't know how you get there, but...
You got everyone pumping up over here.
Oh, man.
Are you done with your line of stuff?
Wrong.
I had one more question.
You had a follow-up. Okay.
I never really put Mary on a really bad position, but I could put her in a bad position now.
Oh, man.
You don't, I will.
You've seen these targets. Probably.
Can I ask her about the training thing we just
mentioned? No. No, I'm going to ask her about something that I feel pretty strongly about. Not in every case, because I think there are some exceptions to this. But the comments that were made... I'm sorry, Jim, but I have a hard time pronouncing your last name, so... So, but...
How come you didn't do this to him?
Because he's armed.
Sometimes I look at these numbers, and I know that we are going to actually just agonize over every detail in every one of these budgets. But sometimes we have agencies that really don't have much general fund dollars, and they are quite large agencies. Do you think those agencies deserve as much scrutiny as these general fund agencies? Now, that's a terrible position. I'm having trouble with one budget, actually, and maybe I'll get myself in trouble by saying this. But the
you have to run for re-election like us, Wigo, not me.
Yeah, but the target for the Department of Administrative Services for cuts, because they only have about $5 million in general fund. Now, of course, a lot of their transfers come from general fund agencies, is about $500,000. For an agency that's in the hundreds of millions of dollars in expenditures.
In defense of the chair of the General Government Committee, who's not here.
I think the chair maybe shares my opinion.
I think the chair does share your opinion.
Well,
and that is the rate discussion that goes on in the General Government Committee about what other agencies are charged.
But sometimes I get this sentiment from other legislators that don't really don't really pay much attention to them. They're not general funds. You don't really need to.
Well,
anyone on that committee would say no.
Mr. Chair, and you can attest to the good Senator Devlin, that this morning I was testifying in front of a committee that does create funding for the state of Oregon, and there are ways. I mean, we do have some ideas about how to save some money, but also how to increase income for that agency, which ends up with more general fund money. Can we get to the point where we need to be there? I don't think we could force liquor down people fast enough to balance the budget. And, you know, I'm one of the few smokers left in the building. I can't smoke enough. My friends and I together can't smoke enough. If you're a true Oregonian, what you will do is buy cigarettes. You don't have to smoke them. Just buy them. You know, I mean, that isn't the point where we're at right now. And, you know, as I said, you know, I'm not going to cannibalize other agencies that I don't represent or that I don't know the intricacies of, because it would be arrogant and not very effective for me to do that. I can help you as you walk through on the agencies that we have an intimate knowledge of, identify things. I mean, I could tell you that you could shut down the Dome building tomorrow and the prisons would still operate. Is that good policy? No, it's not good policy. Would the corrections officers still go to the prison every morning and open up the doors or close them? Absolutely. But it's not good policy, because the parole board's in the Dome building.
Representative Hanson.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. On the same vein, one of the now I'll put you on the spot even more. One of the things that we're dealing with is there's everybody in this building is talking about some incredible levels of sacrifices or offering up some things that 2 years ago or 4 years ago we wouldn't have even considered. And I'm talking about some of the tax exemptions that are near and dear to some people's hearts, people that are talking about revenue increases that I would have never thought it was possible to hear from them. One of the other areas that comes to mind is PERS, and which again we've got to make some incredibly hard choices on, but we'll have to, because we've got to get to a bottom line, and this is, but I won't put you on the spot in terms of asking you for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, let me just assure you, Hasina and I have been sitting in a room for more. We've spent more quality time together this session than we want to think about trying to find some long-term solutions on PERS. We're not there yet. Do I think we're going to get there? I think there are some things we can do that the employers and the employees will agree to, or the employer groups and the employee representatives will agree to at least take back to our prospective organizations and the people that we represent, that will reduce the cost of the retirement system and still provide a reasonably good retirement for people, so that all the folks that we work for and work with can continue to recruit and retain quality staff in the state of Oregon and at the local government levels. Are our people going to be thrilled? No. Is it going to balance the budget? No. I'm sorry, you can fire every state employee tomorrow and you can't balance the budget. That's the reality. And, you know, we can give them all a furlough for 10 days. We can't balance the budget on that. So we have to think beyond cuts. I'm sorry. I'm really preaching to the converted. Don't start me. I sound like Ralph now. You know, we just got to do more than just cut. We can't get there through cuts alone. We have to figure out some other things that we all can agree on. Maybe you all could just take a holiday from beating each other up, you know, over taxes, and sign a truce, you know, and let's figure out how to get it running again. Oh, okay. Well, whatever.
I'll be banished to the Senate in Switzerland over there.
Anyway, Thanks for the easy questions. Did you have any hard ones?
No. Mary, I will say, and for the benefit of the people who were here, we did have a discussion yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to close the loop with everyone, but there was some discussion yesterday regarding the, not necessarily so much with the state police, but with other agencies, as to what the training costs are and the upfront training costs for certification. And I know state police, we don't pay time and a half during the initial basic training period, but we're going to be looking into the costing of training. Jim wasn't here yesterday. Mary, you weren't here yesterday. I don't know
that we pay time and a half for COs to get
trained. Just so everyone knows, and for the public record, we're looking at pricing some of those things, at paying it straight time instead of time and a half on some of the training issues. So that was one of the discussions we had.
You know, and I'm clueless on that. I really hate to admit it, but I am.
Well, no, I'm not asking you to comment on it. When we have
really
an opportunity to raise the flag, we will take a look at it.
Well, and as you know, I'll be hanging out with you.
You'll be around.
I'll be around. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. You did a great job. If you were nervous, you did wonderful. So, no problem.
They're done with their hard questions now.
Thank you.
We're going to get the Hasina and Kevin show.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Kevin Campbell, the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I have no voice. And so Hasina, who I trust completely, will be speaking on my behalf. But I did want to mention just a few real brief things. First of all, you already heard from two of our members. You heard from Chief Mark Croker from Portland Police Bureau, and you heard from Chief Mark Adams, the president of our association and the chief in Kaiser, about our support for the Oregon State Police budget. I'd echo I think everybody said that this is a budget that's been under a great amount of scrutiny, and I think that the scrutiny that it was under last session when a couple representatives worked to try to improve the ratio of supervisors to troopers could be put under the category of healthy. It makes for a more healthy organization. I think they now have become a malnourished organization, and at this point, cuts are to the bone and create an unstable organization. That's nothing new to you, and it doesn't make your job any easier. Frankly, your biggest decision, the biggest decision that gets made for this committee, is the one that's made when you're given your piece of the pie. That size is the critical piece. And that's why I hope as constituents we're helpful to you in arguing wherever we need to argue for a little bigger piece of the pie for public safety, because we do believe that, with the exception of corrections, it's grown at a great rate over the years. Other agencies within public safety have not, and there is not as much to cut there. So that is a side note from what we really want to share at this point, but I just wanted to recap a little bit of our position on this. We, of course, are particularly concerned about the whole forensics issue. We talked to you about that. The fact that we don't have enough troopers on the road to cover particularly rural parts of the state where we're very concerned, along with a lot of other things. I'm out of my voice, and now I will go to my spokesperson, Hasina Squires.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon, the Association of Public Safety Communications Officers, National Emergency Number Association, Oregon Chapters, and the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, and I have waited so long for the moment that I would be the spokesperson for Kevin Campbell. Go baseball. Okay, I just had to say that. I've been waiting to say that all for just for, you know. Really want to just focus on one portion of the state police budget, which, as you know, the Office of Emergency Management budget is within the state police. Want to just recap sort of a little bit of what's happened with the 911 tax fund and advocate for the governor's recommended budget of $64 million expenditure authority. During the last legislative session under House Bill 3977, the House, the committee name somewhat escapes me, Ways and Means Committee, it was the House Advanced E-Government and Technology Committee.
Or two committees, actually.
Okay. Representative Patridge served on with Representative Hill chairing that committee. The 911 tax did legislation did go through that committee and then ultimately went through full Ways and Means. under House Bill 3977 from the last legislative session, this legislature chose to change the nature of the fund from a non-limited fund to a limited fund. And the general premise behind that was there are a lot of dollars flowing through their telephone companies and wireless companies, collecting dollars, passing them through to the state and also to local jurisdictions, and the legislature felt uncomfortable just having that be a non-limited fund, wanted to make sure that they knew how much money was actually flowing through that fund. And so the nature of the fund was changed to a limited fund, and the premise behind that was only for purposes of the legislature to understand how many dollars we were actually talking about instead of granting permanent authority. There was no discussion at that time over concern regarding full expenditure authority to be able to be given, just merely the marker of where are we with this fund. Under House Bill 3977 from the last legislative session, the non-limited fund was capped at $56 million, and everything above that that came in at $56 million for that biennium was then earmarked to go into a primary public safety answering points consolidation incentive fund. So local governments and the state enhanced 911 sub-account was foregoing money that could have gone into those traditional revenue streams to a new account built for consolidation incentive. During the first, second, and third legislative special sessions, legislation was introduced and passed to take money out of the PSAP Consolidation Incentive Fund to redirect it to the state's general fund. It was vetoed in the first two legislative sessions, and in the third legislative session, special session, it was signed by the governor. So out of what happened last legislative session, $7 million out of the incentive fund did come out and was redirected to the state's general fund, money that would have typically, had that fund not been created, money that would have gone to the state to fund the enhanced 911 program and local jurisdictions, city-county distribution revenue streams. In addition to that, during the third special session, $2 million out of the enhanced 911 sub-account was redirected to the state's general fund. I bring this all to your attention because there will be a great deal of discussion regarding the consolidation reports that were required under House Bill 3977. And the main point that I'd like to get across to this committee is those funds are what we consider to be dedicated dollars. People expect that their money is going to be used for 911 when they see it on their telephone bill as a 911 excise tax surcharge of 75 cents per line capable of accessing 911. They expect that the money will go to 911, and so we just want to advocate for the full expenditure limitation authority that's contained in the governor's budget. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Appreciate your time.
Paul?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. It's hard for a lawyer to do testimony in two words, but I could summarize simply by saying I agree. And that would probably cover all except two points that I want to make. All but two. And so, first, I agree with Mr. Bakwanis in his testimony about the nature and the necessity of adequate funding for public safety. I agree with Kevin Campbell and Hacinus Squires on the need for the 911 funding and the extension of the cap. I agree with Mary Bodkin with respect to the need for the public safety system to continue to be viable, trying to give you something that you can use so that you haven't already heard. And so I would offer just simply two things. When the subcommittee was involved with listening to the public safety system mapping process early on in this legislative session, a lot of people from a lot of different aspects of the system came together to present you with information that they thought would be of use to you as you deliberate. And there were two things that I got from that discussion that permeated the whole presentation that I would just like to leave you with. One is the interconnectivity of all these different components of this public safety system. if you haven't got 24-hour, 7-day-a-week law enforcement capability in your area, you've got a serious problem. And if a law enforcement officer arrests somebody and takes them to an overcrowded jail, and the officer's sitting out in the squad car filling out the police report when the offender walks out the back door of the jail, that's not a good thing either. And when the prosecutor says, you know, the crime lab won't give me the information because it's too low a priority, I can't tell whether this is a controlled substance or sugar, that's not a good thing. And when the public defender is cut short on funding to the point that there is no indigent defense for that offender and the offender walks out the door, that's not a good thing. And the correction system doesn't have the capability to punish that offender or to rehabilitate that offender through parole and probation, that's not a good thing. But the aspect of the balance and the interconnectivity are just as important as the various components of the system. They're not silos. They're not silos. They're interconnected and they're interdependent. And so to bolster up one piece of the system without taking into account the effect on another, or to cut one piece of the system without taking into effect the effect that that has on another, is going to result in a system that's out of balance and unsupportable in terms of its viability. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've got nothing more to say. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions for Paul? Thanks, Paul. Anyone else wishing to testify? Anything for the good of the order, Doug?
No, Judicial Department starts on Monday. Courts.
And just for the committee, the dynamic on the Judicial Department is a little different. As a reminder, the Chief Justice has a budget, the Governor has a budget, and so...
And they're a few million off.
And they're, I think there's about a $26 million gap in between the two to keep the courts fully going. So keep that in mind as you take a little more.
Chief Justice is $26 million lower than the
Just kidding.
How did that compare to the chair's guideline?
So the Chief Justice's budget is even higher than the chair's guideline, but the chair estimates that there's about a $26 million gap
after looking at it. So I just encourage you, I think everyone's received a copy of the Chief Justice's budget as well as the Governor's balanced budget, so it will be an interesting, it will be one of our more interesting hearings.
I think we have 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks.
Well, the next week is judicial, and then we have a couple days for Public Defender Services Commission. Right. And then the DA for a day, and then dispute resolution for a day for the next 2 weeks. So there's a week for the judicial, and then a week for other sort of judicial-related entities.
So we're not going to get to see Doug next week. So nobody shed a tear or anything. We'll be okay.
One of the ironies it seemed to me on their budget is they invite the Judiciary Committee to have lunch with them, but not the Ways and Means Committee.
They actually invited us to have lunch with them, with the court, and I advised them that since we had their entire budget and I didn't know how we could talk about anything in relation to the Judicial Department without talking about their budget in light of the press scrutiny surrounding public meetings law, that I suggested that we not go down that path. It would not be a good thing for the court, nor would it be a good thing for the legislature to meet with the justices, for the record.
If it's by design and not by accident...
We could have had an open public meeting and had lunch, and that might have been entertained. And Christine could have come and recorded us eating lunch together. So that might have been interesting. Anything further for the committee?
Mr. Chair, I will be getting you questions as they come in. We have 7 pages of questions just on the state police, just for the responses. And there are still just DOJ questions coming, and I have some on the criminal fines and assessment that I'll get out to you probably tomorrow for responses to questions.
And just for the edification of the committee, I'm planning on giving to committee members a copy of the
the priority list, just a working list that I tried to help put together to look at the various components of the public safety system on Monday. I'm having people look at it and give ideas, and it is merely a working list. It is by no means anything that I want to direct the committee towards. It's just something so we can continue to have a conversation about the system as it works together. And as we heard today, we're going to have to lop off big chunks of the system at this point in time. Otherwise, the thing's dysfunctional. I think that that's my view, and generally in talking to each of you individually, that's the view of the committee. So, all right. With that, we are adjourned.